When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist with the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andy.
Today's guest on the Music Buzz is Grammy-nominated singer-songwriter Peter Case. The acclaimed musician's latest album is Dr. Moan. And today we'll delve into that, plus his long-standing career, his solo career, his years with the Nerves and the Plimsolls and more. So please welcome to the Music Buzz, Peter Case.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to talk to you today, man. I'm a fan of your work. You're one of those rare kind of singer-songwriters who's equally adept at crafting literate storytelling lyrics and instantly hummable melodies. That's not an easy thing to do. And I love the two songs that I've heard from Dr. Moan. I'm totally stoked to hear the whole thing. Downtown Nowhere's Blues. I love it. It's cool. And I love your piano playing on it. It's one of those songs that on first listen, I could say, man, I could hear that covered by people in any number of genres.
Totally.
It's like fantastic. That. It's fantastic the way it is. But, you know, it's immediately heard it. I could sing along with it. And especially the Have You Ever Been in Trouble? A killer song in a great video. I'd say my favorite song of the year that I've heard so far that anybody's done. And I don't like music. I don't like anything. Ask these guys. I'm pretty hard to please, like, man.
He didn't tell you, Peter. This is the only song he's listened to.
That's right. Show, that's
I like how in the room you are on Have You Ever Been in Trouble. That the piano recording is pretty lovely. I mean, it really is. And your voice, it's right there in front of you. It's a really beautiful track.
It's raw and intimate. It's really good, man.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. You know, this whole record kind of came out of the pandemic because that was such a difficult time for everybody. But I was sitting here, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure we're probably all in the same boat. Like, you're like, all the plans for the year just went away.
Yep.
We didn't know it was the plans for the next 2 or 3 years, but it was the plans for, I'm like, oh my God, the plans just went away. This is going to last at least a year. And I'm like, there's no gigs. And like, I'm just like, I'm going to go nuts. And there's nowhere to go. And it's like, sounds like a ghost town out here in San Francisco and everywhere, you know, and like, oh my God, you know? So, and then I look over there and there's like a Baldwin Acrosonic spinet, you know, upright piano sitting right over here. It's like the Acrosonic's the one that like a lot of the piano players in rock and roll like it because it's a real rock and roll piano. And somebody gave it to me.
But you didn't record on that for Have You Ever?
No, I didn't. I wrote it on that though. You know, it's in this front of this room, you know. And I'm sitting here and I'm like, oh my God. Like, oh, well, I've always loved playing piano. It's always been sort of my kick, you know? Like I do it sort of like for an escape, you know? And I'm going to play piano every day. I guess that's it. And so I just started playing all the time. And, you know, the people on the street were, you know, people walking by in like the ghost town out there, like, hey, man, are you the guy playing piano up there? You know, and then the neighbors, like, I'm playing the same songs over and over again. The people upstairs are like, wow, I like that one. You know, it's pretty. So that's the kind of conversation, music business conversations we were having.
I like the way you arrange what you play just on those tracks that I heard from Dr. Moon. It sounds like Dane was saying, nice and raw and intimate, but it also, I know listening to you play that you work those parts out and it's really well done.
Yeah. I mean, I sat here and played and it all came into focus over like a period of, I don't know, 9 months or something like that. So it's the first time in a long time I had the opportunity to write the record and learn the songs and then go record it all in one thing without having to go on tour. You know, in a way that was an advantage because.
Yeah.
You could stay focused, and you're right. You know, it really did capture the, you know, it is an intimate feeling, even though some of it rocks in an intimate way. You know, there's some tracks on the record that rock, you know, it's all the same people playing on the whole record. It doesn't really get, there's only one song with guitars on it.
Who do you listen to? What piano players have inspired you?
And some of the ones that really inspired me were, you know, guys like Floyd Kramer and stuff like that. But I like.
Oh, yeah.
I went out to Benmont Tench's house one time. He's another one. And I went to his. We both knew this girl who carried me out there one day. And we talked about Floyd Kramer and we played all that stuff. And then I love.
Without Floyd, there'd be no Elton. That's for sure. I mean, those.
Right. And then I love gospel piano and I love blues piano, Otis Spann. But I especially love this guy, Jimmy Yancey. And he's kind of like, yeah, not that many people know him, but you might really enjoy it because like his he plays a boogie woogie player. He was the groundskeeper at the White Sox at Comiskey Park. Huh. But he was a boogie woogie piano player that pretty much is known for inventing boogie woogie, like Ahmet Erdogan. Looked for him and found him and made a record for him. And, you know, and he's really great. And it's simple. And so it's something like some of these guys, they come on and they're just like such monsters on the piano, like, Ammons and, Pete Johnson and all that. But Jimmy Yancey kind of has this like intimate thing. And I think he's the guy that invented, you know, the old boom, doom, do, 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 do.
Yeah. Oh, really?
That, you know?
Pre-Fats Domino, maybe.
Yeah,
huh?
Pre-Fats Domino, you know, just like, you know, you listen to Robert Johnson and you hear dun, 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 dun. You know, it's like the guy that pretty much seems like he may have invented that thing on the guitar that Chuck Berry used. Well, Jimmy Yancey invented the thing that Fats Domino did, I think.
How cool is that, man?
It's very beautiful. So I listen to that. You know, I like that. I like Monk because. He's so beautiful and like he. There's just something about it that's so fresh and so on. I just love his music. And I like the solo Monk records. You know?
Are you a Terry Adams fan? Because he's pretty Monk-oriented.
Terry Adams is great. Yeah, I love the way he plays. We just did a record a little while ago. It was like a tribute to one of the songs our NRBQ did. We don't knock on my door. It's on YouTube. It's on Spotify, you know.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I did that one, played the piano on that. And, he's great.
Did you amble into the doors of Billy Payne and Mac Rebennec?
Oh, God, Mac Rebennec. Yeah.
I'm
a big fan of that, too. And love that. I love that solo Boogie Woogie record he made that you could get back in the 80s. I don't know if you can still get it. It was Dr. John plays Rebennec or Rebennec plays Dr. John. I can't remember.
Who's the girl that's burning up YouTube right now? She sits down with really classical chops that plays this insane boogie woogie.
I don't know who it is.
No, but you check it out. If you just type in girl playing boogie woogie, I mean, she'll be at the top of the list, but as someone that plays piano myself and enjoys, you know, over the years emulating people like Leon Russell and Elton John, this woman's got some hands. It's amazing.
So Peter, when I was reading through your bio and stuff, obviously that Wendy had sent over, there's just so much in there. You know, I read a lot of bios because I do, you know, marketing, PR stuff, promoting shows and bands. But, you know, the things that stuck out to me is like blues as a kid, street singing in San Francisco, grew up in Hamburg, New York, you know, in part of the punk rock movement, singer, songwriter. It's like you're like the, you know, the vegetable soup of music.
Genre jumper.
Yeah, man. Which is soup, but it works. And it's not like, it's kind of been your thing. And I guess my question is that on purpose or is it just kind of just who you are, you know?
Here's the thing, man. It kind of is who I am because here's the deal. It's like I started out when I was a kid, late 60s playing, you know, and so there was like a really, like in 1968, I was 14 and I was listening to Taj Mahal and I was listening to the Birds and I was listening, the Birds were doing country. I was listening to the Incredible String Band. I was listening to John Wesley Harding, which was the first Dylan record I actually bought when it came out. I had the other ones. And so I'm listening to all that kind of stuff. And then I'm also listening to Silent Way by Miles Davis. Loved all this kind of stuff.
I love it, all those too. Yeah, that's a great.
I was hanging out at this record store with this woman, Mrs. Cox, you know, and she was like, she had a little record store in Hamburg and we would hang out over there. And I thought, you know, she's like an old lady. Like she was probably like 32, you know.
Oh, and, yeah.
She was really beautiful. And she had like, you know, like this, you know, it's B-52 kind of thing going on. But she would turn me. She was going out with Freddie Green at the time.
Oh wow! Chink chink chink. Huh. Yeah.
The
greatest
the guitar player for Count Basie.
Yeah.
And so she would talk to me about. Well, she knew him. Anyhow, I don't know. You know, I was too young to really know what the hell was going on. But she turned me on to a lot of music, and so that was the start of it. And so I loved Dylan, and I also loved rock and roll. You know, and my big sisters were like Elvis people. I was the youngest kid in the family, so I grew up in a house filled with Elvis and Ray Charles and the Everlys and all this kind of stuff that these teenage kids had when I was little. And so I grew up in it. I get out to California, I'm playing on the street and I'm like, it was always about songs really. And so I started trying to learn songs and to play songs. And the Nerves was like a real basic version of songwriting. And like, I threw over a lot of things I was influenced by to be a Nerve. The one guy in the Nerves were just like really focused. It's got to be 2-minute songs, like really melodic, get right to the chorus. I go, what, you know, he goes, everything else is terrible. You know, that's the way, you know, the punk rock era, you know, 1974, everything else is crap. I go, well, what about, you know, the band or, about, you know, oh, the band, you know, they're no good. Well, what about Bob Dylan? Ah, forget that. He used to be great, but he's not great, you know, this kind of thing. But I didn't agree with that, but I threw it over because I wanted to learn how to play bass and learn how to play in bands. And so I really did learn how to write songs and play in a band, you know, like, you know, and work with people. And that's what the Nerves was. But it, I was, as the Nerves broke up and I wanted to put together a band that could like do what the Nerves were doing, songwriting, which was like very melodic and simple songwriting, really. But also be able to blow the roof off the place as a band. And that's what the Plimsolls were about, was,
yeah.
Nerves, you know, the Nerves could write the songs, but we were like kind of more, we weren't as strong live as the Plimsolls. You know, I put together a band that could really rock the house. And we did that.
You sure
did.
Yeah.
We had the songs, you know?
Well, I was watching the footage of you at the Hollywood Heartbeat in 1980, the Plimsolls, and it was really good, man. It was really good to.
You guys were rocking, man.
Yeah, we were really rocking. It was, we could project rock and roll. That's what that band was about. You know, like we just knew how.
But you also had the sophistication of Elvis Costello and the Cars kind of permeating through there. It wasn't just, you know, raw in your face punk. It was
songwriting was good.
That's exactly right. And so that's the thread that goes through the whole thing. And then and then finally, like when I left the, like, you know, the Plimsolls like added more influences to the music. Like the Nerves were like a real fast version of like Motown and Burt Bacharach and the Stones or something. But then the Plimsolls let in like sort of like folk rock and soul music. And then when I left the Plimsolls, I was like just letting in all the music I loved. I grew up on Mississippi John Hurt and Muddy Waters, but also like jazz and all this stuff. And I started putting it all together, you know, so I've just been following the that thing. But to me, it doesn't really feel so much like genre jumping as it just feels like unraveling the mysteries of music and getting close, always trying to like tune into the wavelength of where the songs are coming from.
And some of the great artists of all time, it's, you know, Bob Dylan's always done that. Neil Young's always done that. I applaud you for doing that. I mean, you know, always this record's, you know, I mean, there's folk, gut bucket blues, rockabilly, power pop, piano pounding poetry. I mean, it's all cool stuff, man. Everything that you've done.
I agree. Like you follow the things that excite you. I mean, there's no point in like, run to daylight. You know, I run, you know, follow like what you love, you know, put what, you know, we were told, you know, we used to talk about it and like, it's like, like the great thing a band can do or a singer can do is like just put everything that you love into a song. the thing that you really would love to hear.
Mm, sure.
You know? What's the thing that just blows your mind right now? And then that's what we try to do.
And you do that also, not only in terms of genre, but in terms of just production and arrangement and choice of instrument. I mean, you listen to a song like Two Angels, which is just beautifully recorded, and it's slicker than other things, you know, like Intella Hotel or something like that. You know, you play the instruments that work for the song, and you don't seem to think about the albums, or, you know, the album's components melding such that they become a Fleetwood Mac type album. You know, like some albums sound like they do from front to back, and yours don't. Yours seem to move with the song, which is cool.
This new album's got some variation on it, but it's all pretty much the same lineup. But I know what you're saying. Like some of the records like really cover a lot of ground, like that record I did with T-Bone Burnett. Like that was like just really a sampler of like all the different kind of music that I was into. And then a record like Blue Guitar, it's kind of a little more focused. And I have this record called Full Service, No Waiting. And it was kind of like a lo-fi version of a thing that we recorded like in an office room with a kid playing drums on a suitcase. And that has like a vibe to it. We did it on like an ADAT or something like that. And it was funky, but it had a real vibe to it. The whole thing.
I'm going to guess you're a Tom Waits fan somewhere in there.
Yeah, I love Waits. You got to be.
Yeah.
Gotta love Waits, man.
Right?
You gotta love Tom Waits. He's the greatest.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you the one of my favorite records that I mean I was kind of listening through and listened to as much of your stuff as I could. The Let Us Now Praise Sleepy John record. Oh, man, that's the one that really hit me. Underneath the Stars. You guys need to listen to that record.
One of the records that got nominated for the Grammy.
That's one of the best songs I've ever heard. And
well, thank you, man.
Ain't Gonna Worry No More. It's another great one up there. It's a really good record.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a real stripped down record. Richard Thompson's there with me.
Is Richard on it?
Richard Thompson's on the first track. And there's a couple other tracks. There's like Norm Hamlet from Merle Haggard's band plays on the record a little bit. But which was really fun to play with him. Basically, it's a solo record. Like those ones, I used to get these records when I was a kid, like Burt Jansch. And you would get like Don't Bother Me by Burt Jansch. It would just be him playing the whole record. Or like Freewheeling by Bob Dylan, or one of those early Bob Dylan records. So Another Side of Bob Dylan, where it's just like him with a guitar with the songs and the singing.
Yeah.
I wanted to make a record like that. And so because that's what I do on the road. You know.
Your music is as diverse as your album covers. I was looking through your album covers today, and oh my God, there's a lot of great stuff. I love some of the urgent doodles, you know, that you have going on with Sleepy John, and then out of nowhere you got this six pack cover. It looks like something that R. Crumb would have done. Remember
that guy's a pretty famous
artist. R. Crumb. Yeah, he was great.
Yeah, that's a pretty famous artist named Jeffrey Valance.
Yeah, well, it looks famous, even though it's really quirky and, you know, it's lovely stuff, man. I didn't know his work, but
I got hammered for that over in England. People are like, if this is what passes for painting in Los Angeles, you know, they should be ashamed. And I don't know, like, you know. Well,
I used to live just north of you in St. Catharines, just across the. Niagara on the Lake. And we would go down to the Albright Knox Gallery.
Oh, yeah.
Father would take me down there at age 11, and I would look at a Jackson Pollock, is now $30 million per canvas. My first thought was, I could do that, you know, not understanding the process.
Maybe you could, you know, but it's very beautiful, isn't it? Like, I used to go to the gallery too, you know. By the way, the guy that did the latest cover is from right near St. Catharines. He's got this thing called his name's Greg from Blind Pig Press, and you can check him out online. He makes his own fonts, and he's been coming to I played at Ani DeFranco's place a few years ago, and he came down from Canada to come to it. I used to watch St. Catharines hockey on TV. That's how close Pete and Frank Mahovlich and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, I was super into it. And in Buffalo.
What's the font guy, the guy that made the fonts?
His name is, it's called Blind Pig Press. And
is he the guy that, did he draw the piano on the cover too?
Yes, he did. I did that picture of the guy inside. It's one of my doodles. But He showed up at my gig in one time when I was playing Ani's place, and he had this thing. It was a picture, a really insane picture of me, very visionary, weird picture of me playing outside. You can see a city in the distance, and there's all these waves, and I'm playing the guitar, but there's a million. It looks like a hallucination. And I said, well, that would be great, but I can't. I would like to use it for the record. I've got it up on the wall here, but I said I can't use it because it's a piano album. He goes, no problem. So he made me the piano, you know. His fonts are really cool. You check out blindpigpress.com, I believe.
I will, for sure.
Can you point your camera to that picture that you got on the wall? Is there a way to do that?
It's over in the other room. I could
probably. Oh, okay. Never mind.
When we get done here, maybe I'll do it.
Yeah, okay.
St. Catharines was an interesting time in my life. I was at a public school there for the 3 years I lived there. And one of my classmates ended up being the drum tech for Neil Peart in Rush. Turns out Neil lived 10 minutes away from me, and I never met him until years later when we were on the same label together.
Wow.
And the star man, the naked guy that I never paid, he's from St. Catharines too.
So who is?
The guy that plays the part of the star man for Russia's Love. He's from St. Catharines. Wow. So I have nothing but fond memories. I used to pick strawberries out in Grimsby. And
yeah, it's a beautiful part of the country. I mean, it's just right over the border from where I grew up. I mean, it's basically the same part of the country. There's just a border in the middle of it. But I used to go up there a lot. I used to hitchhike up I used to go over the Peace Bridge when I was a teenager. Hitchhike up the Peace Bridge and get picked up and drive up to, we'd go up to Stratford or.
Beautiful, yeah.
Different places up there. I used to play different coffee houses and stuff up there and travel around. Hitchhike around up there was always fun, you know.
Did you ever play the riverboat? Was it? A time when you were
I did.
You did, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same place. I played this weird dockside place in somewhere up near Stratford. I forget what it was called. But I played a million gigs in Toronto going back to, I opened up the Crash and Burn Club in 1977 with the Nerves.
I don't know that
first club, punk rock club of Toronto. It was the first time my parents came to see me play, like drove up from Buffalo to see me at the Crash and Burn Club. It was like,
how'd that go over?
Yeah. I mean, they were happy that I was still alive and working.
So speaking of that, I mean, you've been a lifelong touring artist. I mean, obviously, I'm looking at stuff. I mean, you guys were with the Ramones and Devo. And so, you know, over the years, I mean, what are some of your fondest memories of just touring in general, whether that be touring with specific acts like that or on your own or, you know, kind of. Go down that road with us a little bit.
Those things were amazing because you didn't know really what was going on. Like when we played with Devo and Peru Ubu, we were just like kind of stumbling around on this like independent tour that nobody knew anything about, you know. And so it was like a very we were an indie record like with no record company support, and we got on the phone and booked some shows, and then we just come into Cleveland and the opening act is Devo at Players Club. It's like, oh my God, these guys are incredible. And then we did two nights there, and the next night was Peru Ubu, and they were just both incredible. And then the Dead Boys came to the show, you know, and so that was very exciting. Touring with the Ramones was exciting. We just did it for a brief part in the Rocket to Russia tour. We played up in we played the Midwest, and then we went down and played Texas with them. It was really exciting and fun. I mean,
what year would that have been?
77. May or June or July, I don't know, somewhere in the middle of 77. Wow. So that was super exciting. Every once in a while, you have those nights on the road, like you go, oh, this is why I tour, you know. Sometimes it's so fun and you go, oh, this is so much fun, you know. I mean, a lot of the slogging is, usually it's when you meet other people and they show up and you have like an interplay, maybe with the other act on the bill or something, and it's pretty magical, you know.
Yeah.
So there's been a lot of different experiences. We played gigs on the road with Tom Petty's band, and we played with, but solo I played with everybody too. I opened shows. I've opened shows for rock bands, you know, as a solo artist. Because I grew up on solo players too. You know, I saw Lightning Hopkins play and people like that. James Taylor too, for that matter, who was a great solo act. I saw him play solo, or John Hammond Jr. or all those guys, they would play solo, and like you could, I saw John Hammond Jr. open for a rock band, and he just blew the place away. And so yeah. I got into, I played with the Replacements. I opened up a show for them solo. I opened up for Husker Du solo.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, those are tough. You know, they're good though.
It all makes sense. I mean, I know those audiences and knowing your music. I mean, it does, that's the beauty of what you do, is that you're really able to meld into a little bit of everybody. And it's not like, what the hell is this? This doesn't make sense.
Especially the Replacements. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a tough, you know, that was when I was drunk and they were sober. It was the strange part about that period of time.
I didn't know they were ever sober.
When I played with them, I was like drunk out of my mind. And they were like Paul particularly was like really, really clear eyed and sober. And they were great, super great. But, you know, one of the secrets to what I do, I think some other people can relate to this, is I was a street musician as a teenager. Well, that meant you had that. You were out of the corner. It was in San Francisco, and these people would come down. They'd be all walks of life, from like tourists to the strippers to the soldiers and Marines going by, and like, you know, everybody's going by out there and Broadway and North Beach. And you'd have about 10 or 15 seconds to get their attention, to get to play a song, maybe make some money off of them. And so you had, like, it was like a training ground for being rejected, but also for cutting through. And also just that moment when you open up your guitar case on a city street and you pull the guitar out and you start to play, it's like there's 15,000 pounds of pressure to not do that. It's like, you're not supposed to be doing that. And, you know, you start doing it. And then you're like, in a way, I got more comfortable playing than I am, like, even usually just hanging out at a party or something. I can just go out. I can talk to people. It gave me so much playing on the street. And what it didn't give me was much money. But what it really gave me was, like, a great experience for play. And we would play. I would get out there at noon and play until 2 in the morning.
No kidding.
Day after day after day. I did it for a couple of years.
Get your chops together.
Yeah, that's all I got. You know, you get your fingers. You know,
and your voice.
Your voice, yeah.
Confidence, too. You know, the confidence and having the balls to go out and do that. I mean,
it gives you that confidence. Yeah. It gives you a thing that cuts through. They say that, look, I would sing at Broadway in Columbus, and they set up by the Coffee Gallery, which was 2 blocks away. You could hear me on a Friday night, you know, all the way up there, singing over the traffic. No amps or nothing.
Well, Bruce Coburn, who I mentioned earlier, one of my favorite singer-songwriters from Canada, he bussed in Paris for 2 years.
I bet he did. Yeah. Ramblin' Jack used to bus. I mean, a lot of people. Bruce lives here now.
Does he?
Does he really?
He did a couple years ago. I met him right before the pandemic at a. He was reading from his book at a reading, and I went to it and talked to him for a while. You know, he's one of those guys. I just talked to him, like, I didn't.
That's really a good book, the Rumors of Glory book that he wrote.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. I just talked to him, like, we just started talking, like, we had a whole, like we'd been talking for years. Like, we just started talking. It was fun to talk to him.
One thing I read about you that I wanted to ask about, since you moved back to San Francisco, it said you've been attending the St. John Coltrane African Orthodox Church. Are you still attending there?
No, I'm not. I was doing that right up until the pandemic, and any weekend that I was in town, I was doing it. They're great. They're a very beautiful church with a great message and a great musical presentation. And they're every week. You can go to them at St. John Coltrane. You can Google it. And they have a service every week, and I think it's online. But they have a new piano player now. I couldn't make it for a while. And I mean, they weren't doing services through the pandemic. Now, at that thing, like, I just kind of happened into it. They had a great piano player who moved over to Sacramento. And so I showed up one day, me and my wife went to it. Denise says, Archbishop King is up there, is his name, Archbishop King. And Archbishop says, does anyone here play piano? They have like horn players and conga players and a bass and a choir. And, you know, and I didn't raise my hand. My wife just takes my hand and pushes it up. So they go, you, come on up.
No pressure there.
And so I started playing, and it was so great. And they asked me to come back again the next week. Now, I'm not really a jazz piano player, but I can play rhythm piano. And so, and I started to learn how to, you know, stack those chords so you could play that modal music with them. We would do Love Supreme and Lonnie's Lament and Alabama and Spiritual and Resolution. One time I go, man, it's really hard playing that Resolution. And the guy says, one of the pastors says, well, maybe you're not resolved enough.
Oh, God.
They don't ever, they never tell you what key. They never tell you anything. They would just tell you the name of the song. And like, they were jazz people, you know?
Mm.
And so they don't tell you what to play. They never tell you, you just play. And then after about 2 months of going there every Sunday, the bass player turns around to me and says, you're starting to get it. You're starting to get it. Well, that's a good thing because I've been here for 8 weeks.
No shit. I'm hoping so.
But that was great, a great experience for me. And like playing that much every week for a couple hours, like, you know, it's not like a jazz mass where they just have a little bit of jazz. Like they played a lot of Coltrane every week, you know.
Wow, man.
And so like, you played for a couple of hours, you know, it really, I think you can hear that on this record that it built up my, I'm very thankful for it because it really built up my ability to play the piano with some power and consistency a little bit.
Did you go back and re-listen to the Coltrane stuff to bone up for that? I bet you did.
Oh yeah. I had to bone.
Yeah.
So I started, you know, yeah, definitely. I went back and I listened to all of it and a lot of other things too, but I definitely listened to McCoy Tyner.
Oh, sure.
Like he invented a way of playing with John Coltrane that really nobody else had done before. It was that fourths, you know, and he stacks mm-hmm. these chords and they're modal, but they move. And you can, once you learn it, you can kind of like go up and down and play all sorts of scales and music and melodies with the chords and this whole thing. I mean, he was a classically trained, great, you know, virtuoso pianist. But I did borrow his, I mean, I had to do that with them.
Yeah.
That's cool. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah,
I'm going to have to get online and check that out. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, John Coltrane, St. John Coltrane. And they have beautiful icons there. They have this, Mark Dukes is a painter that paints icons, and he paints these amazing icons of like Black Jesus and Coltrane's saxophone, but he's like, Coltrane's wearing robes, and it's like a icon of an Orthodox church, but it's Coltrane with like flames in his saxophone. And very beautiful, man. They're really,
that's
really,
wild.
Really amazing. Yeah, you'd love it, man. You should look, check.
That's,
he's somebody
cool
to check out too, Mark Dukes, D-O-O-X. He's D-O-O-X. Really a far out artist. Really great. He's a radical. I mean, they're a radical church, you know. They're radical social movement. It's love supreme, you know, one mind, and it's very serious, very beautiful group of people. I got a lot out of it. I was very thankful to be there.
So speaking of, you know, performing and whatnot, what was the first show you went to and paid to go see as a fan? Can you tell us about that?
My sister took me to see the Grateful Dead in 1967.
Okay.
And we saw Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead in Toronto at O'Keefe Center in July of 67.
I played there.
Wow.
Did you go to that?
I played the O'Keefe Center.
Oh, you played O'Keefe Center, yeah. It's a great place. Well, I saw the Grateful Dead play there. You know, it just blew my mind completely. I was only 13, you know.
1967, okay, wow.
And then later on that year, my mother and father took me to a bar in Buffalo called the Royal Arms and saw the Paul Butterfield Blues Band play.
Oh, wow, Michael Bloomfield, yeah.
It was right after Bloomfield had left, so it was Elvin Bishop was playing lead. It was the rest of the band was incredible. And Paul Butterfield was a huge influence on, like,
Sam Lay playing?
No, it was Philip Wilson, and he's an incredible drummer. He played with he played on a few albums with Butterfield right around then. There were two guys in the band that were from the Chicago Art Ensemble. It was Gene Dinwiddie and Phil Wilson, and Philip Wilson's an incredible drummer. And then they had Mark Naftalin and Elvin Bishop, and David Sanborn was in the horn section, but like nobody knew who he was at that time. And they were great, you know, they were so powerful. And it was like they call it a show bar, where like the stage is right behind the bar. There's like a liquor bar there. And then up above it, you know, those kind of places, you know?
How clever.
And they would play there for a week, you know, like bands would come through to play the Royal Arms. Like Miles Davis would play the same club, or you know, Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley played there. Chuck Berry even played there. Howlin' Wolf would play there. But I never saw any of them there. I only saw Butterfield. But it was so, so moving, man. I was just a kid. But to see him come out and, like, just the whole presence of it and how seriously, you know, what a throwdown it was, you know. It just blew my mind, you know. So I saw that. I'm trying to remember when I first shelled out my – oh, I'll tell you when I first paid some money to see somebody that I can really remember. San Francisco, I'm playing on the street, and we somehow see in the newspaper, Doug Somm is coming to the Boarding House with the quintet.
Sir Douglas Quintet.
Doug Somm, man, the Sir Douglas Quintet. We, you know, my friend was from Texas. These guys that we had played on the street with, we had a street band, you know. And this guy's from San Antonio. So so we worked really hard and saved a bunch of money. Like, I hope there's still some tickets left, man. And we get down to the Boarding House we played all day to raise the money, maybe a couple of days to get the money for tickets. And then we go down there. Tickets were like $5 or something, you know. They were back in those days, or maybe that was even high. We get in. Like, I hope there's still seat. You know, I hope there's, we can still get into the show. And we get down there. And where is everybody? And then we go in, and there's like nobody there. And then we go down, and there's like about 10 other people come in, and I'm sitting right in the very front row, and Doug Somm with Augie Myers and the whole original Sir Douglas Quintet comes on. It just blows the place away, puts out an incredible show. I'm just sitting there right in front of him watching the show.
She's About a Mover, yeah,
she's
come on.
She's About a Mover, and all
yeah,
that
man.
Stuff, man. Mendocino, and She's About a Mover, and all this crazy stuff. And then the horn band comes on, and Doug's playing like, you know, they're doing like Nitty Gritty and all that stuff that's on that record, Doug Somm and Friends, Dealer's Blues. And it was just incredible with a horn section. He's playing this like T-Bone Walker kind of lead. It just blew me away. And there's maybe by the end of the show, like 15 people in the club. And he put on a great show, too. It was very, very heavy. But that was I don't know why that show was you know, you never know in music why a room looks like that, but he's one of the greats, man.
Now, what about a time when you were, you know, in your career on stage and kind of a pinch me moment, I guess you could call it, you know, any stories like that you can share, you know, on stage with somebody or kind of, you know, whatever it might be over the years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of things there where it kind of blows your mind. Some of them you look back and are kind of pinch me moments, you know, or like, you know, I wrote songs with, at one time, I went over to Willie Dixon's house to write songs with him.
Okay, that's pinch me moment. Come on now.
We didn't actually come out with a thing, but it was just an incredible day. You know, I spent over at his house playing piano. He would have me play piano, and he would write lyrics to the things I was playing. And he told me all this stuff, and so that was super heavy.
No doubt.
And then, you know, I mean, it was fun, you know, we, like, jamming with Tom Petty. We closed down the Whiskey. We had this big sold out show, the Plimsolls at the Whiskey. And then Tom Petty came out and sat in with our band. It was a lot of fun. But, you know, Tom Petty was somebody we really liked a lot. I'm trying to think, you know, I wrote songs with John Prine, and that was a very
moving. Whoa. So tell me about that. No, I did a little recording with John, too. He was one of the sweetest guys I ever met.
But I haven't seen him for years, but I did. I can't remember. I met him out there on the road. Yeah, let's see what happened. You know, I was up in Canada on the blue guitar tour, and I had the blue guitar, my little group, you know, playing that stuff. And we ended up backing up this guy named Jim Rooney, who's a producer. He's produced John's last record, but he's made a million different records. Jim Rooney. He's the guy that started the Newport Folk Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's one of the guys, you know. And
you ever play the Mariposa Folk Festival in Toronto?
I did play that. Yeah, it was a fun one. I definitely played that. That was a super great moment. So we were up there, and I met Prine, and then I was playing the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville. And I'm just on tour. It was about 6 months later, and then there's the front table is reserved at the Bluebird, and it turns out it's just for John Prine, who's alone. And he just comes in and like sat there and like had a bottle, and he sat there and just watched my show from right up front. And I was just playing alone, you know, at that night. And I was kind of nervous, but then, you know, I figured, well, he came to it. So we ended up talking. And I went over to his place, and we wrote a few songs.
Have those come out?
I mean, yeah, he recorded one, and I recorded the other one. The one's called The Wonderful 99, and the other one's called Space Monkey, and he recorded that one on his Live on Tour record. And and he had a whole rap about it. And, you know, yeah, I mean, writing with him was like, so, you know, it's like what do you have to do? I mean, I just basically, we just laughed, you know, and he had these amazing, he would, you know, we'd be sitting there and we worked late at night and nothing much would be going on. And then he'd go, what if you wrote a song? Why don't we write a song about an imaginary, let's write a song like Sink the Bismarck about an imaginary group of heroes. And so we wrote Wonderful 99, you know. Like, how did he know that Sink the Bismarck was my favorite song when I was 9 years old? Sink the Bismarck by Johnny Horton. So he goes, but he didn't even check with me to say, let's write a song like Sink the Bismarck. I'm like, well, right on, man.
That's perfect.
So I was totally into that. And then another time I'm over there and he goes, he was like, he cooked and he was doing the dishes and we're just hanging out and all this stuff. And it's like really late at night. And he goes, let's write a song about the first monkey that went in. He's just kind of looking with a far out look in his eye out the window. And he goes, how about a song about the first monkey that ever went into space and what he's been doing since his 15 minutes of fame ran out.
Wow, that's perfect.
And so we wrote Space Monkey, the premises were so fantastic, genius that they just write themselves after that. And we just sat there and laughed. And then we get done about you get the song done about 2:30 in the morning or something like that. And then he'd call his manager on the phone in the middle of the night. I mean, that guy was up too, you know.
Al Bonetta.
Al, we just wrote a song. You got to hear this. And so I think Al lived nearby. I think he came over. It's like 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and we played him Space Monkey. I mean, those guys, it was so goofy, It was like really fun and funny,
That's great.
He was such a beautiful guy, man.
He really was.
It's already hard to listen to Summer's End without now knowing that he's gone. So when you listen to it, it's doubly melancholic.
Mm-hmm. He was such a sweet guy, beyond just like what he wrote, which was like some genius. I saw him way before I knew him. I went and saw him do a solo show. He was on tour with Nancy Griffith, playing a big outdoor place in L.A. I think they just had a car and the two of them were driving around together doing these solo shows. And it was just fantastic, you know.
Did you see him do the House of Strombo, where George Strombolopoulos, who's one of the better interviewers from Toronto, invites people into his home? And one night it was John Prine, and in the audience was 80-some-year-old Gordon Lightfoot just in the shadows. Check it out. It's on YouTube. Just check
I shared a dressing room with John with Gordon Lightfoot, and I ended up talking to him. I had this whole adventure with him and his band that was like just so funny, man. And we were up in at Mountain Stage in West Virginia. And so Red and those guys are like in one room, and that's his band leader. And then he's in another room, and the drama going on between these guys was so intense. I can't go into the whole thing now, but it was all about tuning. They apparently sometime 30 years. These guys have been together for 1,000 years. So 30 years ago or something, they went on some TV show. Maybe it was like the Smothers Brothers or Laughing, or it was like some huge show from Mesozoic era of TV. And they were out of tune. Yeah. It's never going to happen again. And so Red's telling me the story, and then a few minutes later, Gordon Lightfoot comes in and goes, "You guys. Guys get in tune yet?" And it's like 5 hours until the show. The show's not. But so we got to start tuning. So they start tuning, and they've got all these strobes and all this stuff set up. And I go, "Well, what's the big problem?" They go, "Well, the real tricky part about it is that Gordon always uses one of those beep, 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 those little pitch pipes."
Oh, my gosh.
And that's what he tunes to. So they're in there tuning, and going on and on. And then I'm hanging out with Gordon, and we're talking for quite a long time, and we had a great time. I love him so much. And we were talking, and then he was telling me, the thing he's most proud of is Early Morning Rain, recorded by both Dylan and Elvis. Do I hear you?
Yeah.
I guess I'd be proud of that, too. But then he goes, so we're talking for a while, and he goes, "You ever sing any barbershop, Peter?" And then, all of a sudden that story about the pitch pipe, beep, beep, beep. Like they always used to use that in barbershop,
Get your nose.
He used to sing barbershop, apparently. But so they had this whole thing going on about the tuning. And then the guys in the band were like, we're on the road with him. He's a pilot. And you know, it's like harrowing, you know.
Oh, shit. He's there. He's the band's pilot.
Yes. He had like he had this big two engine thing. And he's like, apparently like not afraid of any weather, you know.
Oh, my God. No way, man.
And he's like, you know, he's like, he's the kind of guy he is, though. He's just like, you know, we're going to fly. And like, I've got it to get, got my own plane. And we fly in and fly.
Oh, my gosh.
But I performed with him. And, you know, that was a pitch me moment, the whole thing. And so that was really fun, you know.
That's awesome. That's
amazing. What a great songwriter.
I didn't know that he flew planes. I didn't know that.
Yeah, apparently he scared the hell out of everybody.
That's the last thing you want, you know, with the LV to be flying the plane too, man, if you're in the band. You guys were a little out of tune tonight.
You wouldn't want me doing that. Yeah.
You ever flown upside down? Hey.
Yeah, I know Petty and those guys used to fly to their gigs, and the pilots used to play games with them once in a while, like put it in a dive and stuff, you know, to scare Tom. And, you know, those kind of, no, thank you.
I had a guy do that to me once. It Did wasn't you? Fun. Yeah.
How are you aware of the word plimsoll?
It was a Jeff Beck tune.
Yeah, Jeff Beck had it. And it's also a Navy term.
It's also the British term for a running shoe.
It's the same thing. Yeah, that's what Jeff Beck was getting at. It's a Navy term. The plimsoll mark is on the side of ships. So we put that on the front of the record. I wish I wouldn't have named the band that. Why? Like, nobody knew what it was, you know. Like, to me, it was just I like the word soul in the name, you know. And so I thought it was kind of like the Yardbirds or something. Soul, you know, the Yardbirds. People like the name because it sounded kind of cool and everything, but like I always like everybody else was called like the Cars or the.
It caught my attention because of Jeff Beck Truth record.
You know, I love had Jeff the same Beck, song. Man. God, there's another one, man. What a great musician.
Oh, jeez.
Well, the only context that I know plimsoll in is having lived in England during the 60s when it was still quite Dickensian, and you could still at a boys' school get caned for any malfeasance. Yeah, you could get six of the best and still have to shake the guy's hand and thank him for the admonition. But yeah, the gym teacher.
Thank you, sir. How about another? Ouch. No thanks.
They used to hit us with rulers at my school.
No, the gym teacher used a size 12 plimsoll.
Oh, really?
Shit.
Get out of here.
Wow.
That's no good. At our school, they had the ruler, you know.
Our principal used to have a whacker, a paddle that had holes in it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, God, man. I got that once. I was a quiet son of a bitch after that, boy. Kept my mouth shut in class.
I quit going to gym after I saw a few people get that. I would just hang out in the bathroom and smoke cigarettes. And then one day, some kid comes down there. His case in here, and I go, yeah. And they go, they want you down at the gym. They're giving them, give you three whacks for every day you miss gym. You've missed like 50 days.
Oh, shit.
They're going to beat me to death.
No kidding, man. Spend the rest of the day and the next day whacking you. Ouch.
Yeah, principal drilled out the paddle to cut the wind resistance.
It made it hurt way more. Yeah, it was weird. It was a weird thing, but I know I can attest that it was not fun.
That it worked. Yeah.
It definitely worked. I shut up immediately.
Well, as a Canadian in England, I can't say it was a fun experience, but the art director in me says, yeah, I have been caned. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, right. It's an experience, I guess, right? Oh, my God. What a planet we live on. That's what Butch Hancock always said. What a planet.
What a planet we live on.
It's crazy, though, isn't it? It's so good.
Indeed.
I mean, I've got kids, and I sure don't want them getting caned, but, you know.
This has been great, Peter. Thank you so much.
Well, great talking to you guys, man.
Yeah, good luck on this project, man. I can't wait to hear the rest of the tunes. The two that I've heard are absolutely fantastic. So.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting the record out there, hitting the road, you know, in a while.
But we appreciate the time.
I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.